Portions of this hour's broadcast are underwritten by Doug Jones and Associates Graphic Design, providing visual solutions for clients since 1986. Phone 263-4511.
Support for KRFY provided by Finnan McDonald Clothing Company, a locally owned and operated outdoor lifestyle clothing and footwear shop for over 30 years, located in downtown Sandpoint on 1st Avenue. More information at finnanmcdonald.com or at 208-263-3622.
Well, good morning and welcome to the KRFY Tuesday Morning Show with me, Julie Calamine, and my co-host, Jim Healy. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning, Julie. How you doing?
Well, really fine. Say, we've got an interesting show this morning, and we are having as our guest today Mark Sauter, who is the Fire Marshal of the Sagal Fire District. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you bet. Before we begin our interview with Mark, our discussion with Mark, we'll talk about the weather and our weekend activities. Today we can expect fair weather. We've had a lot of fair weather. It's currently 55, but we're planning on a high later today of 79 and very high winds, which I think Mark may be talking about later because that has an effect on fire. Tonight we have a low of 49, a chance of showers, and then tomorrow, Wednesday, a high of 75. With another small chance of showers. So pretty nice weather, Jim.
Oh, you can't beat this weather. Somehow we have, a couple days last week were a little bit what I would call toasty, but we have avoided the heat and the humidity that chunks of the rest of the country has been experiencing. We've been lucky.
Yes, we have. And as compared to last summer, we have been lucky. It was so many hot days. I'm loving this summer, my second summer in Sandpoint.
Well, this is the first Tuesday in August, and I'm sure that students are not thrilled about the countdown heading towards the start of the school year, but I certainly enjoy the winding down of summer. I'm not a heat person. I like heading into the fall. How about you, Julie?
Oh, I'm the same. How do you think I ended up here? It's beautiful. Say, what'd you do last week, Jim? The interesting things. You can spare us your house cleaning.
Did that and windows and things like that. But on Friday night, I volunteered at the Panada for a film called Swiss Army Man. And it was simply one of those movies so bizarre that you never, ever felt like you understood what was going on, but you didn't mind it. It held your interest throughout. And you get to the end and you go, what did I see? But it was a good what did I see with Daniel Radcliffe and Paul Dano. And if you have a chance to catch it on, I guess, Netflix or someplace else, rent it and just simply sit back and feel comfortable being in a world that you don't recognize.
Interesting.
Very much so. And how about you?
Well, you weren't indoors all week. You told me you did something
outside. No, I wasn't. On Friday, Sunday, and Monday mornings, yesterday mornings, I was out pursuing the wild huckleberry, and they are plentiful, they are beautiful, and they are getting plumper and plumper, and there's tons up there, so I think everybody should just go up there, and where I go up on Schweitzer, and there's plenty of them up there, but I'm sure everyone has his or her favorite little spot.
Well, you heard it here, everyone. Get out there and pick huckleberries. I had two interesting things I've done since
Dose.
We last spoke.
Okay.
Yeah. The first was that my sauerkraut has finally gotten ready to be put in jars. So my neighbor Elaine and I did that. That
the
was pretty fun.
The saga of the sauerkraut. Now tell me, does the sauerkraut need to be boiled in the jars, or do you just put them in and screw them tight, or do you have to preserve them?
Jim, we are going to have to do a special show on fermentation for you because, no, we don't boil the sauerkraut. That would ruin all the wonderful enzymes and probiotics in there. No, we just put it in the jar and put it in the fridge.
So there's nothing. Oh, in the fridge, you have to cool it?
Well, now I'm keeping it in the fridge, but one can leave it out for a long time. I happen to have finished mine and I'm putting it in the fridge.
What's the shelf life?
We'll talk later about this.
Cool.
It's a long story. And then the second thing that I did, and this was really fun, was that my hubby and a friend and I were able to drift a section of the Kootenai in our little drift boat. That was a beautiful weekend activity. So we had a good
week. What makes a boat a drift boat?
You may have seen them in other parts of the country or maybe here too. They're the double-ended boats that have, they look like a dory really, and they have, they tip up at both ends and they're rowboats. You just row them down the river. Very pretty.
Cool.
Yeah. Well, we need to move away from water and on to fire. And so I'll reintroduce Mark Sauter. Good morning again, Mark.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And I said earlier that you're the fire marshal of the Sagal Fire District. Well, tell us, what is a fire marshal? What do you do?
Typically, you focus on fire prevention activities and emergency preparedness for the residents and the business community of the area.
Yeah, so you're an educator, maybe.
Sure, you could say it that way, yes.
Yeah.
I like to think of myself as trying to do public education almost always.
Yeah.
So, yeah, get out and tell people what they can do to be more prepared to prevent a fire and then what to do in case they do have a problem at their home or at their business.
Yes. How did you come to this job?
I retired from the fire service in another state, came up here and started to volunteer with the local fire department, with Sandpoint, actually. And about a year and a half or 2 years ago, I approached the fire chief and said, you know, if you did some more prevention work, it seemed like that would, you could get some traction with people and residents especially. We only have one fire station in the Sagal area, and it's about 140 square miles. So you really do need to be prepared. It's just a geography issue. You really have to know that to be ready for a problem and certainly to prevent as many as you can, because many areas of Sagal are 15 to 20 minutes away from the fire station.
Distance.
Mark, I'm sort of ignorant about fire districts. How does the state decide the size of a fire district? What determines a fire district?
I think this actually came before me. Sagal started in the early 1980s.
Mm-hmm.
And there's state statutes on it. It was formed, I believe, a number of the property owners back then decided to have a certain size area. They plotted it out,
okay,
square miles, if you will. And then it came to a vote of those that were in the area. And then I believe again in the 90s, they added on to the Sagal Fire District. They chose to include the western end of the Sagal area.
Okay.
Down,
okay,
Duvert, for instance, because I've talked to some homeowners down there.
Sure.
Okay, now, would there be parts of the state that has no fire district?
Yes, that's correct.
Ah, interesting.
I don't think there's very many areas in the Sagal area like that. A couple up on the National Forest area, for instance. I know in some of the other areas of our county, they're not attached to a fire district.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, in the north end of the county, there's some of that.
So would this? So a fire district means that anyone within that district, if he or she has a fire or a fire concern, they can call the fire district and then you respond in whichever way to whatever the person's calling about?
Right. They would call 911 and the fire district, you know, in Sagal's district, it would be the Sagal Fire Station would respond and likely assets from Sandpoint, and then it could be from other areas as well, depending on what the problem was.
Ah, but the call is always 911. You don't need to call the fire department.
No, 911 is always your best mechanism to
get help,
to alert the authorities for an emergency.
Yeah, well, tell us a little bit more about the Sagal Fire District office. How many firefighters are there? Tell us about how that all is in the red building on 95.
Sure, yeah. There's nine firefighters, three per shift. They work a 24-hour shift. And there's a fire chief and an administrative assistant that work for the Sagal Fire District as well as for the city of Sandpoint. So if you think about it, it's two different entities, the Sagal Fire District with nine, and they essentially get, you know, 50% of the fire chief's time, and then their administrative assistant. So he and the fire chief and the administrative assistant manage the two departments.
I see.
So, and since many of the activities are very similar, it would make sense to do that. So, so there's also the Sandpoint station that has nine firefighters as well.
Okay.
So it's very similar that way. There's volunteers as well. We have approximately 24 volunteers between Sagal and Sandpoint. The budgets are completely separate. Mm. The taxing is completely separate. They keep all the finances separate.
But they work together if needed.
Right, but they do work very closely together.
I see.
So it works out really well for the public and for emergency service delivery.
Yeah. So. And are the volunteers scheduled like your paid firefighters?
No, I volunteer as well. No, we come in when we're called.
I see.
Some of the volunteers will spend time at the station. Some just simply respond to calls. Or oftentimes we do public events. We'll do traffic control at different events to raise some money, and then the volunteers will donate that for fire equipment per se.
So when you talk about paid individuals, does that come from taxes from people who live in Sagal, in the Sagal Fire District?
Right. The Sagal Fire District, there's actually a tax on developed structures.
Okay.
So the people that are in the Sagal Fire District pay on that. They don't pay on raw land. And the money there goes actually into the county property tax, but it's a pass-through.
I see.
The money from the on the tax bill will actually show what each developed property would pay into the district.
You might not know the answer to this. So if I own some undeveloped property in the Sagal Fire District, and let's say a fire begins on it, I'm covered?
Well, you actually pay proper, you pay tax to, you pay a fee, I'll say a fee, to IDL as well, because they have a wildland fire responsibility. So I have property out in Sagal that's okay. Undeveloped. So my tax bill does not pay anything into the Sagal Fire District. But I do pay into the IDL fire fund, if you will.
Idaho Department of Lands.
Yes. Excuse me.
Okay.
I should have explained that.
Are there any BLM lands in the Sagal Fire District? I was wondering how that interfaces. Would there be some government funds?
That's a good question, but I don't know.
Okay.
One of the concerns with any kind of a wildland fire is they move around.
They don't stop at your district line,
They don't stop at a barbed wire fence or a couple of stakes in the
there
ground
you go.
And say, hey, wait a minute, this is my property and it's developed. So there's really an incentive to stop the fires, whether it's in the wildland and it's moving towards improved properties. Mm-hmm. So that's why, for instance, Sagal wants to really jump on a fire before it gets a head start on us. So we want to make sure we do everything we can to stop a fire before it gets into the structures. And on the other hand, IDL wants to make sure that we get after the structure fire so it doesn't get into wildland and start running into timber.
Right.
So we all have an incentive to stop the fires and work together. And I honestly think we do a pretty good job of that.
Well, that leads me to my next question. How are we doing over time? Are our firefighters, are our fire methods improving, worsening? I know climate has an effect too.
Boy, that's a big question.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. Really Let's big. Just talk about working together. The departments all work together. They all train together. When they had the fire down in Bayview last summer, Sandpoint actually sent their fire boat down.
Wow.
And stayed off the shore in Bayview to pump water to engines that may need, you know, to fill engines if they needed to. So a lot of the departments work together very well. The state comes in and we have air resources that are available through Idaho Department of Lands.
Okay.
So there's lots of different, you know, resources that the different departments can add to the emergency to make it as short of a duration as we can make it.
Well, that sounds like an improvement. I would think that that has improved over time. I bet you didn't all communicate as well 30 years ago.
Yeah, years and years ago, generally the departments had a not these necessarily, but nationally departments had a history of wanting to do everything on their own and having all the resources they needed. Whereas now they look around and say, wait a minute, IDL has this. IDL has air resources, for instance. So SAGL doesn't need an airplane or a helicopter to drop water. We can generally rely on IDL.
Teamwork.
It's a teamwork, you know, possibility. The downside of that is occasionally you get caught where there's a fire in Priest Lake.
Two other places.
And there's a fire over
just
on the over the border in Montana and then in Washington. And all of a sudden now we're really at a resource.
You mentioned that Sandpoint has a fireboat. Does SAGL have a fireboat?
They just have a small, like a Zodiac. They don't have the same resource needs. So Sandpoint's really the one that has the boat. In fact, they just improved their boat situation. They had a large Boston Whaler boat in Coeur d'Alene. Was able to change theirs out, so Sandpoint picked up their used one, and it's a great improvement over what they had.
Do they now have two boats, or
they sold the other one off? So equipment for all the departments, it's a good thing and a bad thing. The good thing is you have it when you need it. The bad thing is you have to service, maintain it, and up here you have to store a lot of the stuff in the winter.
In the winter months,
you have to really be mindful of watching how much equipment you build up. Because obviously there's really a cost, and there's a manpower cost too, or staffing cost to maintain it. So the fire chief and the departments are pretty mindful of that.
So it's pretty much a cooperation among the different departments, the different fire districts. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that, the fire does not stop at a district line. But the other element to think about is the air quality, that the fire might not be close to Sandpoint, but the air quality could be really terrible because of the fire. So it's in everyone's best interest that everyone gets along and teams up on it.
Right. It's really that the incentives are all there from an environmental perspective to a property perspective, to insurance, everything, to watch and be mindful of the fires that are burning. I mean, we all remember last summer that was pretty smoky for, most of August.
Well, it was a dry summer and a dry spring as well.
Yeah, so.
Well, let's move on to common causes of fires. You must have many, many, many causes of fires, but what are the ones you're normally thinking about or worried about working with?
Well, if it's a homeowner that's all of our listeners generally are live someplace that, home or apartment or something. Everybody has the same risk. They have a risk for their kitchen, kitchens, kitchen fires, heating systems. We go on about 10% of our fires every year are heating system related. Mm. So up here, a big thing is to watch all of that. So there's ways you can, whether it's getting your stove and fireplace serviced, whether it's watching what you do with all your firewood, what you do with your fuels, whether you use propane or not. There's all these different things, but a lot of people think, well, I'm only going to think about a forest fire. But really you have, I call it three real risks for fire. The first risk is inside your house. The second risk is, do you have anything that's near your house, i.e. another structure, like your neighbor lives within 5 or 10 feet of you, how they manage their house or how you manage that other building can make a difference. That's what we call a exposure. So you have an exposure to that risk. And then the third issue would be the wildland. There's a fire that starts on your neighbor's property or starts on your own property, in your woods or your acreage, and then burns into your own house. So three things: interior, that exterior exposure, and then the wildland.
The last one would be like an act of God, a lightning strike, that sort of anything.
Sure, it could be anything, but what happens often is we have a problem with people burning their slash piles.
Or tossing a cigarette.
Right. And a lot of it is, in a way, it's, there's an act of God or just a pure accident.
Mm-hmm.
But people being mindful of how they handle their slash piles and burning in particular makes a big difference, especially for their neighbors.
Those slash piles are kind of intriguing to me. Coming from Minnesota, that's not something we do out there. And I'm just wondering what you, the fire department, think of those and if you have any information about how that affects air quality.
There's a burn permit process. We're in the burn permit time now. I don't think really that many people are burning their slash piles now. They're not even asking to burn. Everybody knows it's dry. And for the most part, logging's going on now. They're piling. If you're here, the first snow is when we get a lot of the piles that'll be touched off and burn off a lot of our piles.
Yeah.
So, and we do have a inversion layer issue here occasionally. So we'll watch that. But we honestly, we don't get in the way of kind of some of the current, the practices.
Sure. If there is an inversion, do you have the ability to ask them to do less burning or not really?
We'll list it on our website, and all the people that burn are asked to go to the IDEAL website, so they get direction that way. And for the most part, I think people go along with it.
Yeah, good.
Mark, I have a question I might have missed about the first snow. Does the first snow usually increase the number of fires or what, people burning?
It's a comfort level thing, really. The people that have many of these slash piles that are built up, a lot of them work all summer to build it up. They'll hand build these piles, or sometimes they're done with heavy machinery. And then it's a matter of waiting for them to dry out. And then it's a matter of, okay, well, when are we going to light this?
With the first snow, you figure
it's dry inside.
I gotcha.
But it's wet in the woods and all the way around it. Or a lot of guys will wait until we get 2 to 3 inches of steady rain in the fall. But it's, the piles don't light as well in February and March. So the trick is to start at the beginning of our late fall or early winter.
Now, does one need a permit to do that? You were mentioning permits.
IDEAL, and it's an online thing. It's not an onerous process to do that. But IDEAL, I think, requires a permit at certain times of the year. And I believe it's sometime in October. You could go to the IDEAL website, but it's sometime in October, they'll open up the burn process, and then they'll keep it open and typically until April or May.
Okay.
But I will say that a year ago, when we had that dry spring, mm-hmm. we were having lots of problems with slash piles and people burning. And they were getting into grass fires, and that was in March,
right.
So which is really unheard of. Now this year we didn't have that same problem, but last year we did. So just because it's burn season doesn't mean it's necessarily safe. You still there's still precautions that you should take.
You really have to be alert. You're tuning in to 88.5 KRFY, community supported radio for North Idaho, and we're talking with Mark Sauter, fire marshal for Sagal Fire District, and we're going to take a fire break, and we're going to talk more with Mark when he comes back. I've got queued up Bruce Springsteen with Fire.
I'm driving in my car, I turn on the radio, I'm pulling you close, you just say no. Say you don't like it, but girl, I know you're a liar. 'Cause when we kiss, I'm fire. Well, late at night, I'm taking you home. I say I wanna stay. You say you wanna be alone. Say you don't love me, but you can't hide your desire. When we kiss, I'm fire. You got You gotta hold on to me right from the start. A grip so tight I couldn't tear it apart. Nerves all jumping, acting like a fool. Your kisses they burn, but your heart stays cool. Romeo and Juliet, Samson and Delilah. You can bet their love they couldn't deny. Your words they split, but your words they lie. When we kiss, I'm fire, 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 fire.
And you were just hearing Fire by Bruce Springsteen. However, if you'd like to hear another version, there's a Pointer Sisters version that we could listen to another time. Can't hear them all today. Well, listeners to KRFY 88.5 FM, today we have the Tuesday morning show, and our guest today is Mark Sauter. He's the fire marshal for the Sagal Fire District. And we've been talking about general fire-related items. It's interesting. We've asked questions, but I'd like to move us on to talking about fire prevention and safety. And the reason I would like to do this is that last Wednesday, Mark came to my house in Sagal and did me a wonderful public service, which was that he walked around my outside of my house, talked about my inside of the house, and we went through everything that might be a fire hazard. And I think that's worth talking about. So let's talk prevention, Mark.
Okay, where do I start?
I know, it goes on and on.
How about if I start it at the road?
Good.
Okay, we like to think that everyone knows how to dial 911 if they have an emergency. And not all emergencies are visible from the road. A lot of people will think, because I go out and visit most new projects. We get alerted from the county with this. And lots of people think, well, if I have a fire on my property, then you know the fire department, they'll find us. It's not a big deal. So I'm usually, as I go out and visit with people, I'll say, well, you know, there's no road sign a couple of roads down. And usually it's a little farther away from the highway, and because not all roads are marked. We have a really good map system. All of our people generally bring their smartphones, and there's lots of different systems. But all those things, one, need to work. And the other part of it is they all take time. So I always encourage people, do you have a road sign? And the next question is, do you have a house number written, you know, posted down at the bottom of your driveway? Oftentimes we can see the house from the road, but we can't necessarily see the numbers on the house. And oftentimes, in your case, there's two houses that come off one driveway. So the question is, which way do we go? Do we turn right or do we turn left?
Well, Mark, I always tell everyone, stay right. What's the problem with that?
Well, the message doesn't always get through in 911. The other thing is that's you, but your husband may be the one that called 911.
Good point.
And be searching for, you know, hoping that we find him quickly or find you. So it's just because one person in the family knows directions doesn't mean everyone in the family does.
Or it could be your neighbor calling in, and both of you are gone, and so house numbers are important. It could be right. Someone not there, knowing that you're on holiday or someplace else.
Absolutely. And in Julie's case, an arrow on a tree with a number would be very helpful. And in Julie's case, I believe the numbers are actually flipped. Your neighbor's number is posted on one side of the driveway, Julie's on the other.
Does that count as confusing? Does that count as an exposure issue since it has to do with my neighbor?
No, I wouldn't call it an exposure issue. But the bottom line is it, and we get it all the time. My friends can find this place. Like I said, yeah, but we may only come here once a year, or maybe once every 5 or 10 years. And just because one of the crews knows where you've been doesn't mean that the other two crews would know that. So the simple, you know, white letters on a green reflective background, and we've all seen that as we drive down all the different roads around in the county, sure is very helpful. And when you really need our service, you know, usually it's somebody's unfortunately having trouble breathing, or it's a medical issue, or it's a fire issue. the last thing you want to do is see a fire engine out at the road, you know, double clutching and backing up and going forward for 15 to 30 seconds. So you really want to be careful about that. So post your numbers, post your road signs. If it's a county road, the county will be responsible for the road signs. So you might want to look into that as well.
And make sure that those signs are readable too, right? It's got to be something a person can read.
Yes, thanks. I've ran across a number of people that actually have their address numbers carved into rocks. And it looks beautiful, especially in the bright sunlight of in August. It's a different story here in the winter. It's a different story night.
You know, don't put it on a rock unless it's like about a 12-foot rock.
Right.
Because, you know, if snow comes along, it covers it up, you're back at go again. You have no idea.
Right, and contrasting numbers. So that's why we really put emphasis on that, those basic reflective letters on a green background. It's easy for us to see, and we can all test it. Just drive down the road at night and see if you can see anybody else's numbers, and they're very visible.
Well, that's pretty basic. I think we can all handle that.
Yeah. Well, the next thing you'd want to think about is, what's the road like from the county road or the private road that you may be on up to your house? Is it a passable road? Is it something that you don't need, you know, that you can drive a fire engine on, which is typically, you know, 8 feet wide, but we like a 12-foot, 13-foot road. Is it an all-weather surface? You know, are we going to sink into the mud, or is it well prepared? Do we have 13 feet of height that we can pass? And a lot of times, people will drive back and forth in their cars, and you get lulled into complacency and think, "Oh, this is great. You know, all I need is these two tracks that I can follow follow up with my Subaru." And it just doesn't always work that way when it comes to a fire engine. So what's the road like? In your case, Julie, when I visited your house, you have a nice wide road. It's rock base. I don't see any problem getting right up to your front door with a fire engine, which is great. That's not always the case. Oftentimes we'll find corners that are too sharp, or we can even find a hill that's
very steep. I was going to say, what about elevation, yeah, you know, the angle?
Yeah.
Yeah, the grade can be too steep. So if you have trouble getting in and out of your place when you're not necessarily in with a foot of snow on it, but if you have trouble getting in and out of your driveway, you know, think about, okay, what's it going to be like in a fire engine?
Right.
Now, I have had people tell me, I get great comments when I go out and visit people. You know, they got here, you know, with the cement truck, and we didn't have any problems with, you know, getting our foundation poured. When did you pour your foundation? Well, it was July. I go, okay, well, they didn't pour in March or April, and they didn't pour in November, so that's a problem.
You don't have to run off to a fire, do you?
No, I don't. But
okay,
I
we heard dinging.
Yeah, I didn't put my phone on silence. Excuse me.
That's okay.
So we talked about the road. We talked about address. We talked about a street sign. The next thing would be, is there a turnaround up at the property? That's great. That's not necessarily a requirement that we would have on an individual house. In fact, we have very few requirements. Most everything that I do when I come out and meet with homeowners is suggestions. We make recommendations. There's lots of different standards, if you will, to encourage people to what we would say is do the right thing to protect their own properties. So we really can't say enough. We want to encourage everyone to do the right thing and protect their own properties. There's lots of case studies out there of people that have said, "Well, I have insurance. I don't really need all this fire stuff because, doggone it, I'm covered." If you do the work and you really look into lots of these major fires, for instance, in Colorado, they've lost 200 homes at a time, 500 homes at a time, in the Colorado Springs area. All those people, most of them had insurance, and most of them suffered severe loss. Even though they had insurance, whether those properties, the things that are not insured, the things that they thought were covered that were not. So we tell everybody, make sure you know what is covered on your own home and what is not. And generally, it's an eye opener when they speak with their insurance agents to make sure that they're on the same playing field, if you will.
Well, part of the difficulty with what you're talking about, some things will have monetary value, but other things have emotional value that becomes irreplaceable, and it might not show up on your insurance. But how do you replace a photo album? How do you replace, let's say, a memento from a grandmother or grandfather?
Or even worse, a favorite pet or something like that. Who wants to have to go through the experience of a fire at their home? That's really not what anyone wants.
I guess what I'm thinking of when Mark is talking about, room enough for fire engines to get in there and road signs and whatever, 5 minutes can make a big difference. You know, if a fire truck is looking for a road sign or the numbers on a house, 5 minutes can be crucial, or if they're backing in, trying to get up that hill again. So what you're talking about is when you talk about you can make a suggestion, but you're really saying, in one sense, minutes are crucial.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. If you've ever had any medical emergencies, or if anybody's had a breathing problem, hold your breath for 30 seconds longer. It's not something that you should joke about, but on the other hand, seconds really count. So we tell everybody, think this through. It's your own family members that are more than likely the ones that really need the service. It's not someone else. It's your own family or your own friends. So take that to heart. And you're very right on the insurance issues. There's a website called Ready, Set, Go that will encourage people to build a list of what they need to take with them if they need to go right away. Generally, there's evacuation notifications early in a incident, and they'll start talking about it. If you want to evacuate now, go ahead. There's no forced evacuations. But if you go to the Ready, Set, Go website, and if you just think about it, what do I really need to take with me? And usually it's kind of if you want to take an armload of stuff, here's the basics. If you want to take more than that, the second step may be the photo albums. But the first step is, the insurance documents, the mortgage documents,
children,
kids, pets, all of that stuff. Mm-hmm. But we have people in Sago, for instance, that have horses. Mm. So what do
animals,
they do?
You bet.
I met with someone a couple weeks ago. His wife has a horse, and he asked me, "So what do you do?" And I go, "Well, I guess in stages, the worst case scenario is let him loose." But I said the first thing I would do is back up your horse trailer, hook it up to your truck, and at least have the gate down to where if you needed to go. And I said, that seems like it'd save you 15 or 20 minutes. He said, you're right. He said, we've not really thought that much about what to do if we really had to go. So I said, start thinking about, okay, if I needed to go, what's important? If I need to go, what can speed this process up? So firefighters will generally have what's called a go bag at home. Mm-hmm. And they know if they get called to go into a fire and they may have to go for a couple of days, they'll have all the basics. They have an extra toothbrush. They have all the battery charger for their phone. They'll have a few things that they know, hey, these are some basic things that I can have in a bag and ready to go. And the same goes for homeowners in fire situations. And we all know this is a fire season now. Today's a red flag day. We have, some serious winds that are going to come in this afternoon. So everybody knows, hey, we could have a problem. Today's not a day that you're going to want to do any kind of burning. You're not going to want to go out on your property and run machinery if you don't have to that would cause sparks.
So. I'm thinking of when I was a kid growing up, I was a scout, and my first merit badge was firemanship. And one of the things we had to do with our families was plan out exit strategies if the house is on fire. So what you're talking about, Mark, like rehearse with the horse, ways and avenues out of the burning structure, let's say if a doorway is blocked, things like that, that, God forbid one should ever have to go through something like this, but it would be better if it's going to happen to have rehearse things, have a strategy rather than be called, have it happen to you and you have no response whatsoever.
Yeah, so we've gotten up to the driveway, Mark. We know what to work on so you all can get there. Now what should we be looking at? What's next?
Well, I want to just go with one thing Jen mentioned, and that is the exits from the house. There's lots of different websites you can go to. The National Fire Protection Agency has exit drills in the home that you can go through. When I visited Julie's house, one of the questions I had for her is, how many doors do you have out of your house?
Oh.
And in Julie's case, her and her husband said, well, we have 5 sliding doors or whatever it may be. But I ask everybody, how many ways out of your house are there? And oftentimes there's a front door and a back door. I've yet to find anybody that only had one entrance into their house. But also, you know, usually you'll have what's called an escape or an exit window from all your bedrooms. But that's not always the case. We don't have a building department that regulates that in the Sagal area. So it's up to the homeowners to build their houses the way that they think is the safest. And if they're drawn up by architects, they usually follow all these regulations. But regardless, how am I going to get out? And your point is so good about planning. I used to ask people when I do presentations, okay, what are you taking for granted? And that's the thing you need to think about is, okay, I'm taking for granted that I'll always have a way out of my house. Okay, is that really sound? It is if in fact your house was built well and you haven't put too many things inside your house.
Oh, right.
Blocking passageways.
Right.
Just like we depend on lots of power. We're going to have power for our smoke detectors, for instance. Well, unless you have battery backup smoke detectors, you may not have that power. So think about what you take for granted and then start wondering, okay, well, what's my backup?
I'm thinking about the battery I took out of my smoke detector the other day. I guess I better get that back in there.
Yes, you change your clock, you change your battery. So they do make smoke detectors now that last much longer. But the old adage is at least a fair one, meaning check your smoke detectors at least twice a year. They're easily tested, and you can go from there.
We test ours when we burn something in the kitchen. Boy, you know, I mean, and it's in the oven, and we turn on the oven, and it starts smoking up the place. We know that our battery automatically gets checked practically every week in the winter months.
Okay, there you go. You know, you asked me about what's the next step for checking your house. In your case, I think I asked about water supply.
Yes.
What do you have for water around your house? In some cases, some people in Sagal have what's called a cistern. They have a 2,500-gallon tank that's underground that the fire department can use. In many other cases, there's water on the property, or there's water that they share with a neighbor, or there's a fire department connection somewhere in the neighborhood.
Meaning a hydrant. Is that what you mean?
Well, hydrant, or sometimes we'll have a device that we can actually pull water, draft water from a pond or from a creek. And for instance, in the Blacktail area down in the south end of the county, there's creeks that cross that road. And we know that on our mapping that we can get to that water. But in Shepherd Lake, there's a draft point.
Okay.
So there's certain points that you can get. In other areas of our county and in Sagal, it's pretty dry. So we remind people, where's your nearest water supply? And oftentimes, and I'm working with a homeowners group right now out in Sagal off of Discovery, trying to encourage them to put in cisterns that would help everybody. So they're in a neighborhood shared cistern system to see if we can help out that way. So it's just things that not everybody thinks about.
Right.
You know, it's like water. It's like, well, you know, they'll bring some water. Well, we really bring a limited amount of water if we had a structure fire.
So your one truck full of water is not going to put out a big fire.
Generally, we'll bring the first in truck will have close to 1,000 gallons, and then we have the ability to bring in a couple more, but then we have to start shuttling. But when your hose lines will spray 200 gallons a minute, that doesn't last. 1,000 gallons doesn't go very far.
Yeah, that's not very long.
So we ask everybody, you know, what's your nearest water supply? And it may not just be us that's going to use it. You know, we have one fire engine in 140 square miles. So it may end up being, you know, you may end up being your own fire department for a little while, especially if you have a brush fire out, a wildland fire out in your area. Some people will elect to pump their own water out of a cistern and and keep everything wetted down or run their sprinkler system.
Oh, sure. Just keep your property wet.
Having a supply of water gives you lots of options. Having no water limits your options.
Not many there.
So the next thing I'd look at, or we look at, is what are the fire-prone spots? In your case, Julie, most of those areas were pretty clear. But lots of houses have different valleys in the roofs that are full of pine needles and
leaves.
And a lot of people, what's the big deal about that? Well, the big thing is a lot of times we have a wildland fire approaching, the embers come like a blizzard and they drop off and it's not the direct contact from the pine trees that are nearby it's impinging on your house. It's the embers that are blowing in ahead of it that light the easily ignitable combustibles that are around your house. Whether it's in a corner of your house that traps stuff, whether it's underneath your deck that's full of pine needles that have also been blown in, or it's your rain gutters that are full of debris that ultimately burn, or it's the area on your roof that burns. And then that fire in a real small confined area can burn through your roof, or can ignite some of your siding, or can ignite other combustibles like the firewood stacked against your house, or the lawn furniture that may be on your deck, or the wood deck itself. So it's all those little things. So I kid people and say, you want to make your house like Teflon, to where nothing really sticks to it. So you want all of the natural debris to go past it or be cleaned off. And then if there is a wildland fire in your area, you want those embers that may hit your house, but they're going to bounce off. They won't have any combustibles to ignite. So that's the fire-prone spots. You need to watch that. And then construction materials, hardly anyone builds with combustible roofs anymore. Almost everyone uses a metal roof or an asphalt shingle roof. Those are the right things to do. And then the siding, if you can use non-combustible siding, that'd be good too.
Okay.
Any more steps that one can take?
Sure. The most important one after taking care of the inside of your house is the defensible space area around your house. There's a lot of different information out there. You can go on IDL. You can go on the Selkirk Fire Department has information on that. You can go to the National Forest Service. You can go to Idaho FireWise. They have a website as well that will talk about different defensible space. But generally, you want a 50 to 100 foot area around your house that's fairly clear of growth. And that doesn't mean you can't have a lawn. That doesn't mean you can't have some trees. But you don't want a stand of lodgepole pine as thick as dog hair that goes right up to the side of your house. Having trees above and that rub up against your house and up against your roof.
Not a good thing.
We all moved up here. We all love the woods. No one really wants to live in a parking lot. But on the other hand, we have to be smart about it. So generally, you want 50 to 100 feet of space. You want your combustible area to ramp up to where you can have your woods 50 feet out or 100 feet out. And you can also thin a lot. In Julie's case, I pointed out that some of the woods that are around they're really not even healthy for the trees. They're so thick that the trees don't really grow very well because they fight for light and fight for moisture. So a healthier woods would be
thinning
the threat. And you've heard the ads on on radio about thinning the threat. And there's different web information on websites as well. University of Idaho has extension programs as well for forestry, and they help out with forest health. And forest health is good for home health.
And Mark, you said that there are classes people can take to learn more about that.
Yeah, the University of Idaho has an extension program for forestry and lots of family forestry information. And we have people that I've been through most of the classes. We have people in the classes that have 1 acre forest. So you don't need, 100 acre family forest or you see all these signs on people's gates. I have a, forest steward. It all starts with your own local forest.
So thinning, that would be sort of the last step, thinning and getting combustible trees out of the harm's way, really.
Right. It's like anything. Thin the load. The less there is to burn, the lower your heat's going to be and the less embers you're going to have.
Okay, before we let Mark go for the day, Julie, you mentioned that you had your home inspected. How did you arrange that with Mark?
Well, it's interesting. I first heard from a friend that I met on the Bonners County Gardeners Tour that she had had this tour and learned so many things that she was just completely unaware of. And I said, how do you find them? And all I did was call the Sagal Fire District and talked with the administrator there. And she said, Mark will be in touch with you. He works Wednesdays.
Yeah, Ruth Ann.
Yes, Ruth Ann. Very nice person.
If anyone lives in Sagal and they'd like a home visit, we'd be happy to come out and see them. We're of the opinion, and you eat the elephant one bite at a time. And if we can get neighbors working with neighbors, that helps as well.
And do you have that number, Mark? I should have it, but I don't.
I think I have it here on my business card. I'll have to pull it out. It's not a number
I
call very often.
I think I can find it.
I have it. Here we go. It's, I can just read it, 208-263-3502. And the website for the department is Selkirk, is www.selkirkfire.com.
Perfect. So for the listeners out there who would like an inspection of their home to find out how they're doing in terms of fire safety, Mark has done a great job, and I could recommend him to everyone.
And again, it's not a we're not going to make requirements of you. It's really a recommendation.
Yeah, no, you didn't.
Suggestions.
Yeah,
he didn't come out and give me a checklist and say it'd be back in a month or anything like that. Nope, he just gave me a nice, luckily rather small list.
Common sense suggestions, I would imagine. We've been here with Mark Sauter, Fire Marshal for the Sagal Fire District. Mark, we'd love to have you come back again because I think the information you provided this morning should be repeated. You know, in other words, that one can never, ever have too much information, because when you see on, like on the evening news of houses and areas devastated by wildfires, you go, where does one start again? You don't ever want to have to face that. And
we didn't get into the interior very far of the house. Okay. So that would be another day's topic.
Will you come back?
Absolutely.
Okay. We're going to exit out here with a short song. Fire theme. This will get you going in the morning, wake you up if you haven't been woken up already. Jimi Hendrix with Fire off his first album on Capitol Records. Here is Fire by Jimi Hendrix.
Stand next to your fire. Try to give me your money. You
That's Jimi Hendrix with Fire off of his Reprise Records. Are You Experienced? We want to thank Mark Sauter again for coming in, and he's going to be coming back. We've invited him back again. Coming up tomorrow on the KRFY Morning Show with Susie Prez, her guest is going to be Mandy Evans, the executive director of the Panhandle Animal Shelter, who's going to talk about ambassadogs.
Ambassadogs. I want one.
And a new Panhandle Animal Shelter adoption program, home to home. That's 8 o'clock tomorrow. And then on Thursday, I'm going to be back here with Susie Prez, and I'm going to talk about the station's iTunes library and music that has been added that you've been hearing over the air. We're going to review some of the music. And plus, we'll take a look at the upcoming festival at Sandpoint, the first weekend with Bruce Hornsby, Railroad Earth, and Emmylou Harris.
And I'll just mention that next Tuesday, we are going to be having the long-awaited Habitat for Humanity with Terry Smith. We'll hear about their projects and learn more about Habitat. And then upcoming events, Jim, Festival at Sandpoint, Memorial Field,
ta-da,
starting this Thursday. I know it. Our first person is Bruce Hornsby and the Noisemakers. And then Friday, August 5th, we have Railroad Earth. And Saturday, August 6th, oh boy, Emmylou Harris. Sunday's the family concert, and you can get more information about that at festivalsandpoint.com. After that, or about the same time as that, we've got the Long Bridge Swim. There's a lot going on this weekend, Jim. That's Saturday, August 6th. You can find out more information about that at longbridgeswim.org. And remember, registration closes today, so if you want to do that swim, you better get online. And finally, August 3rd through 7th, we have Panada Movie, which will be Free State of Jones, and that's with Matthew McConaughey. We all know where the Panada is. If you need more information on that, it's at 263-9191. And then finally, we've got the PRCA Rodeo, and that's this weekend, 7 p.m. each night. You can call them at 263-8414. Is that it, Jim?
That's it. We're winding down. Coming up at the top of the hour, Bird Notes. It's advice for beginning birders. And then we're going to have another fire song coming in right after that. Talking Heads, Burning Down the House. Thank you so much for tuning in.
And just remember, the fire department's going to be at the fair this weekend, too. So check them out at the county fair next weekend.
Thanks for tuning in to 88.5 KRFY.
This is KRFY 88.5 Ponderay.
This is Bird Note. How do you get started learning to identify birds? There are so many, and they hardly sit still long enough for you to have a good look. Well, David Sibley, who literally wrote the book on identifying birds, has some advice.
Spend time at home, paging through the field guide, and at first, names like Scoter and Vireo and Egret are going to seem strange and foreign, but by flipping through the pages of the book and looking at the pictures and reading the names, you'll start to get a sense of what those birds are, what makes a vireo a vireo.
From someone who's observed birds with great interest for years, here's a welcome note.
It doesn't have to be about seeing a lot of different species, but more about getting to know the birds that are common in your neighborhood or in your yard. It can be really rewarding at that level. Another thing that I think is incredibly useful for a beginning birder is to get in touch with a local nature center or Audubon chapter. Someone can take away all the uncertainty and say, yes, that's a song sparrow. Your first 25 or 50 species are the hardest ones to learn. So if you can find somebody who can help you with those, you'll have a really good, solid start.
We're ready to help, too, at birdnote.org.
You are listening to Otto's Eclectic Mix here on 88.5 KRFY, Panhandle Community Radio.